to write this down. I don't wanna tell you how I feel right now. I don't wanna take no time to write this down. I don't wanna tell you how I feel right now. Hey, tomorrow may never come for you or me. Life is not promised. Tomorrow may never show up for you and me. This life is not promised. Perfect man, I'm trying to do the best that I can with what it is I have. I ain't no perfect man, I'm trying to do the best that I can with what it is I have. Put my heart and soul into the song.
Yes, yes.
I hope you feel me from where I am to wherever you are. Tomorrow may never come for you and me. Life is not promised. Tomorrow may never appear. You better hold this very moment very close to you
right now.
Very close to you
right
so
now.
So close to you
right now.
Sometimes I just want a quiet life. Me and my baby, me and my lady. Sometimes I don't wanna get in snowball. Sometimes I don't wanna be a soldier. Sometimes I just wanna be a man. But homie said, shine your light on the world. Shine your light for the world to see. My hobby said, shine your light on the world. Shine your light for the world to see. I'm on black people. My dream was said.
Thank you guys for tuning in. This is DJ Ambush. I am sitting down with Hank Willis Thomas. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Great to be here.
Good, good. So we have your show coming up, or your exhibit coming up. All Things Being Equal at the Portland Art Museum. Mm-hmm. Really excited about that. Tell us, what brought you to Portland? What brought you and that project to Portland?
It's great to be here in Portland. I was invited by two curators from the Portland Art Museum, Julia Dolan and Sarah Krajewski, to do a survey show of 20 years of my work, which is an opportunity that artists rarely get, and I couldn't help but to say yes.
Well, I'm very grateful to be able to be a part of this in any shape, form, or fashion. The numbers, you know, doing some promo around this piece. I did receive the book already. Sat down with it. I had to do it in, I had to take some pauses, man. I go through a couple pages and a piece will hit me and I sit down and just walk away from it and then come back, go through some more. I'm really, really new to the art world. I've been following some people online. Swizz and the Dean Collection introduced me to other artists. So, you know, it's an opportunity to sit down with an artist like you. Mm-hmm. Excellent, excellent. And I want to feel like this conversation can kind of bridge the gap for those that are new to the art world, you know? So let's start with this. Let's start, we're going to take it from a comic book standpoint. Give me your origin story, sir. How, what brought you to this point? What were some of the early stages of you engaging art?
Well, my mother is a photographer and art historian. Her name is Deborah Willis. And she, at a young age, realized the absence of black photographers in mainstream kind of photography world, and noticing the difference between how black people tended to represent African-American community in a very different way than was popularized, and that the work of black artists and more specifically black photographers needed to be promoted and supported.
Okay.
So throughout my life, she was working at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, and then at the what was then called the National African American Museum Project at the Smithsonian, which later became the National African American Museum of History and Culture. National, you know, whatever.
Yes.
National Museum of African American History and Culture. Yeah, so I was surrounded by black artists and black photographers and couldn't help but to find myself kind of roped into it.
Okay.
And didn't think about myself as an artist or wanting to be an artist, but was always curious about images of representation. And that led me down a path of studying photography, thinking it was my own idea, but it wasn't. And then, and then continue to explore into other mediums of art.
Okay. So outside of your mother, what were some of your earlier inspirations and some of the first things you started to do?
Not much outside of my mother or my dad.
Okay.
Both of my parents, you know, they, I think you seem like you're around the same age as mine. I am.
Yeah, we are.
And I think our parents' generation was the first generation of African Americans that had a crack at freedom.
True.
Meaning that, like, they didn't, they weren't mandatorily, you know, organized into segregated schools and, you know, throughout their entire educational experience. Right. And then, had greater access to college, you know, and financial mobility. And they didn't have to play by the rules. And I think we, you know, grew up in the, you know, the hip hop generation where breaking the rules, we had the privilege based off of the work that they did in the civil rights generation.
To
like keep breaking those rules and following our own hearts and minds and recognizing that our creativity is our greatest tool towards liberation. And that was that, you know, so watching television, like all the things that we're not supposed to do, playing video games, watching television, was what inspired me.
Okay. So what was your first piece? What would you consider your first piece?
I mean, I don't know. I don't even think. I mean, I don't think about art as separate from our lives. I mean, I've never learned how to paint or draw. I went to arts high school, but I was in the museum studies program. And I don't think anybody who's known me or knows me really well would describe that I have a definitive talent. I'm an okay photographer, can't paint or draw. I'm very indecisive. So it, I don't have that, like, you know, I have other friends like Kehinde Wiley, who's a brilliant painter, mm-hmm. Wageshi Mutu, and a lot of friends who are like the real artists, you know, but I'm not that.
That's interesting. That's interesting. To be where you are and feel like you don't have a definitive talent and you refer to other people as real artists, that's got to be.
I mean, from the, you know, I mean, from the mindset of what we think about, you know.
Okay.
I've always just thought about myself as a person who can use putting together different ideas.
Okay.
In collaboration with a lot of other people.
Okay.
So a lot of my work is, you know, is a result of me working through the fact that I don't have, you know, the greatest skills, you know, but I do have a lot of good ideas.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of patience to work with others to make those ideas become a reality.
And you're executing.
Yeah.
You're definitely executing. I reached out through social media to ask a couple people, you know, to let them know I was interviewing you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if they had any questions. One of them kind of delves into what we were talking about before, just the whole Portland experience. So you were invited to present here in Portland. Did you have any apprehensions? Did you hear anything about Portland before coming here and you know, Portland's history? The question the person asks is, how does it feel to bring his art to a faux aggressive Whiteville, understanding these same people that embrace him are the same ones that oppress us with systematic racism and endless white savior, hoping to our detriment. This is from a Portland transplant.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what it's like to live here, so mm-hmm. I can't really comment on much of what that person feels.
Right.
I mean, I happen to be, although my work may not always look that way. I mean, I'm an optimist. Mm. You know, I like people. I don't believe in race. I do recognize ethnicity, of course, you know, but I think that, you know, race is a mythology that was built to make some people superheroes and some people villains.
Correct.
And so the more that I embrace that narrative, you know, I'm inherently a villain.
Yeah.
And so I really feel like the goal is to deconstruct this kind of false binary that, you know, I'm sure you've had many times. I've had experiences where people had to tell me that they were black. It's like, oh. And now I have to readjust my lens of how I relate to you, you know? You know, and then I feel like that speaks to, like, you know, the absurdity of races. Like, pick a side. But meanwhile, you know, most people in the world are Asian. They're not black or white. And then they range, and, you know, Asian people are darker than me to lighter than anyone else. And so I think a lot of times we get trapped in the game of race that, you know, white supremacy wants us to play, because it always plays to their benefit.
Gotcha.
So I don't think there is a system that you can participate that relates to money that is not advocating for white supremacy.
Mm.
You know, so I'm like, I have to acknowledge that I'm part of the problem that I'm also trying to address and critique. And, you know, it's easy to try to pretend that it's, you know, it's all, you know, the system and the people, but really the responsibility is on us
as individuals.
And I think when we see, we can learn from previous generations, how, you know, thinking about COINTELPRO, thinking about the way in which a lot of the kind of advances of the civil rights movement and even the Black Power movement were kind of poisoned by animosity and distrust, but also how they were also advocates and allies, you know, who we would call white, that mm-hmm. also were helpful in getting doors open. But that doesn't mean that they were fully on our side, so to speak.
Right.
But they also recognized that there was a role to play. And, you know, so I'm always trying to figure out how to muddle in the gray area,
mm-hmm.
because I think that's where the action is. I think if you stand on one side of the black and one side on the white, that you're actually never really going to get into the thick of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned COINTELPRO. I remember the first time I heard that might have been, it was definitely on a rap song.
Hmm.
Definitely on a rap song. Now that I know that we were born the same year, we had a similar East Coast hip hop experience, mm-hmm. you know, where you were hearing, you know, Mobb Deep talking about certain things, Dead Prez talking mm-hmm. about certain things. And it really did shape a lot of our viewpoints. Like, I remember Behold the Pale Horse. Like, there was a bunch of books and different things that we had to go through as we were, you know, gaining knowledge about, you know, our world around us. And I think to get to a point, it takes some world traveling. Mm-hmm. It takes some getting outside of the box to really see how other people are living, to understand where you are in all of this and how small those perspectives are, you know? Yeah. And I totally agree with what you're saying as far as race and white supremacy and how all that plays out. What effect did some of the music we listened to growing up have on you as an artist?
Actually, growing up in New York City, I mean, when I was a kid, maybe like everyone right. rapped and everyone was a break dancer.
Everyone was a part.
Not everybody was good, but no. That was just a part of it, you know?
Right.
And so I think what's to me, it's really actually more in retrospect, how I realize the audacity of the youth in the Bronx. And even, you know, Rocksteady Park was like just a few blocks from where I grew up in the Upper West Side. That these kids who had virtually nothing decided that a world that was built around not listening to them was going to hear their voice. Like, you know, like, yeah. We don't need anything. We just need each other. And we are going to be so, have so much fun that you cannot deny us.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, and, you know, that gets co-opted and the corporations get involved and all this other thing. But to me, what is the most impactful thing is, you know, that, like, how to go from, like, when we were kids, when, you know, it was just, you know,
we didn't care.
D yeah. And, you know, like,
yeah. We didn't care about the public recognition.
Yeah.
We didn't. It was just, this is what we do. This is how we have fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, I definitely remember, I remember hearing Lottie Dottie in the show.
Yeah.
But I also remember It'll Take a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, and mm-hmm. thinking about, I didn't know what Don't Believe the Hype meant when Public Enemy were singing that. But I remember the feeling of that. That was the first time I saw something in hip hop music that really related to, you know, the images I saw of the Black Power movement. They're like, I think they recreated a picture of Malcolm X with Chuck D.
Yeah.
You know, And that album that really touched me the most when I was like 13 years old or something was Fear of the Black Planet. And recognizing that, you know, being quote unquote pro-black didn't mean being anti-white.
Right. Right.
Which is the greatest misinterpretation of every Black Power movement, is that we don't have to put you down in order for us to be free. And that's something that I think I've always kind of taken with me and reckon in my work. So I don't know if I answered your question.
But no, you did. You definitely did. You definitely did. Let's talk a little bit more about the upcoming exhibit. So what should people expect from this when they,
I don't know. I mean, I really expect, to be hopefully embraced, expect to be shocked and to be overwhelmed, to be challenged, to, engage and hopefully to be touched in some way.
Are there particular pieces that you're curious about the reaction to?
I'm more curious about the reaction to the range of work. Typically, when you go to see an artist's work, you know, people always say, what kind of artist are you? Do you paint? Do you draw? Do you do this? And I'm like, nah. Just kind of do stuff. And there's nothing like standing in a room of 20 years of work and being like, oh, I hope people can see the strands of connection, because I think thematically there's a lot of things that connect.
Okay.
But the work is just, it's so vast and so broad. And I really, I would like to believe that people can embrace an artist that doesn't kind of check an easy box. That's how I see myself, you know, as a person.
Okay. What, how did this become something that you knew you would end up doing professionally as a career? Like, what, was there a particular piece that got placed in the museum? Was it after you put on your own exhibition and the reaction to it led you to where you are? Like, what was that moment?
I think those things kind of happened, but I really stumbled into it.
Really? Honestly. Okay.
Most people, like, they really want to be an artist. They really work hard to do that. And I just bumbled my way into it.
Mm.
I think because my mother is an artist and because both of my parents are so tenacious, there's a part of me that doesn't have a chill and doesn't know how to, like, do anything, you know, in the normal way.
Right.
All my mother's friends who were artists, I was a kid, they were broke. And I was like, I don't want to be
a broke artist. Yeah, like, I don't want to be a starving artist.
Yeah, they work super hard, but they don't make any money. They're constantly begging people to give them opportunities. Like, this is terrible. So that definitely didn't apply to me as a life goal.
Right.
But when I was in undergrad, when I did study photography, and I really did that because that was what I had the best chance of getting into college with.
Okay.
Your grades are okay. You know, you're not that good at sports. You didn't do that much extracurricular, but you did take photography classes. So I kind of got into photography through that. I was on academic probation when I started at NYU, and then managed to figure out now I can perform. I was always thinking that, like, I think what they say, it's not how you get through the door, it's what happens when you get there.
Okay.
And I always lived up to and surpassed expectations when I got through any given door.
Gotcha.
And so that similarly, when I graduated grad school, and I went to grad school because I just was like, couldn't pay my student loans. And I was just like, I found someone told me that you don't have to pay back your student loans if you're in school.
Still school.
So I went to grad school immediately. And then I was in there it was a 2-year master's program for photography. And then I realized that, you know, I could get another master's. So I stayed in school for 2 more years.
This is amazing.
So then when I finished, you know, I had been in grad school for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
And, like, that in a way was like getting a PhD in art, which that isn't really a thing.
Right.
You know, so, and I also had 6 classes of students plus my friends from undergrad who'd all been out in the real world before or after me. And so I had all of these friends who, like, you know, doing stuff like working at museums, working at galleries. And then because I think I'm a nice person and my work is decent or was, you know, people are like, oh, you want to do a show here? I'm like, sure. You know,
why not?
So it was literally my galleries, all my shows, first shows, you know, it was all people I went to school with. And not all were white, but, you know, it was black, white, Latino people. And I think that somehow, so I got opportunity at Studio Museum because of that. Then I got I got a gallery in New York because of something else. And it just all kind of came together. And it really, I remember when I was 29 or something being like, I was 2003 and I was like, I never wanted to be an artist, but, like, people seem to like, I always thought the work that I made was so, you know, like, it was this, at this time it was like Branded Head and Basketball and Chain and these images with, like, Nike swoosh. And it was, like, kind of like aggressive. And I was like, who would want to live with that?
Right.
You know, like, I didn't think of it as art, but I think I was making some kind of social critique that other people saw value in before I did.
Right.
And I was like, oh, I guess I should, you know, I shouldn't work against the fact that people are interested in what I'm doing.
Yeah, go with the flow.
And that's how it all started. And I actually went to see an art exhibition. My friend told me I should go to this art fair that was Art Basel in Miami Beach. And we went there not knowing what art fair was. I really, considering how much I should know if I was paying attention, but there was, so we went to this art fair and someone told us that there was a photograph for $50,000 on the wall.
Oh, wow.
And we were like, $50,000? And they were like, it's an edition of 7 times, you know, there's like all 20 different images. And my friend and I were trying to do the math. And I was like, wait, if her picture is worth $50,000, mine has to be worth at least 1% of that. And I'm like, if that's $500. And if I could sell a couple of those, that's the beginning of a career. And so it really was, and at that same time, I think Bling Bling was out.
Okay.
And Lil Wayne, being 16 years old, had a word put in the Oxford Dictionary of the English Language.
Right.
I was just like, if Lil Wayne has, you know, 10, has 1 million fans, I should get 10,000.
Right.
So a lot of it was really this thing of me looking at other people out in the world who are having an impact, and me thinking like I should be, I'm at least 1% as good as
them. That. Right, right.
Not, I wonder how well I'd be doing if I thought I could do that. I was just thinking I'm 1% as good.
I could pay a couple bills off this 1%.
Yeah, but I'm like, so I aimed low. You know,
I think there is something to be said about the New York environment and studying photography in New York, right? Just like those different environments and neighborhoods and how everyone comes to New York from all over the place, all over the world to live and study. How was that, you know, that impacted you as a photographer, as an early photographer?
Not as much as I had the privilege because of my mom working at the Schomburg Center of, you know, meeting James Van Der Zee and meeting, you know, Gordon Parks and like Roy De Caravo, you know, black photographers who were, you know, are now legendary. And I mean, just that, you know, the fact that I had access to those people was just crazy. And then I went to graduate school in Oakland where the Black Panther Party was founded. And,
right.
You know, meeting David Hilliard and Bobby Seale and Angela Davis and, you know, seeing these people who most of us only know as icons, as like real people, and being like, I can touch you. You're a real person. That kind of really influenced me more than I would say the educational side. The educational side was really seeing some of my classmates go out into the world and be like, oh, I'm going to get a Fulbright and go to the Trinidad, or, you know, I'm going to move to Africa, or I'm going to move to England or Japan, and realizing, oh, you can do that. Like, as a creative person,
right,
you could just move to places and do stuff. And so I learned a lot about how being creative can lead you. As you said, you first came to Portland, you know, with art, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's like, that's a really powerful thing that we take for granted as creatives, that we're constantly, you know, migrating and cross-pollinating.
Yeah. I think we have a harder time as creatives, as, you know, people of color. Creative careers aren't always embraced by our parents. It's more of a blue collar, you know, that's not a real job.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that definitely plays a factor. But when I started seeing friends traveling through their art, whether it was DJing, and I have some friends that are in tech that just, they'll be in China for a couple of years. And it's just like, man, to be able to think that way back in high school, that this was a possibility.
Yeah.
That'd be game-changing.
Yeah.
Absolutely game-changing. Yeah.
And that's the work that you and I, and I'm sure many people who are listening, do. Is just by living our lives, are inspiring other people to think about what else they can do.
Yeah, absolutely. So another question from the online community. What is your process for producing or finding inspiration when the creative juices are running low?
I think when the creative juices are running low, the best thing to do is to scare yourself. Because when you're afraid, that survival instinct kicks
that
in.
Fight and or then, flight.
Yeah, you become really creative.
So what do you use to scare yourself?
I mean, sometimes it's,
you
like,
think, I'll be destitute if I don't get the next piece going? Like, no, what's...
Just invite people... To even if at some point it's like I've made something that, you know, I'm like, I'll invite someone who I really respect and be like, so what do you think about this? Does this suck? You know, what do you think about, is it, you know, is it corny? Is it too obvious? Like, and you know, even that fear of like, you know, having somebody who I really admire look at something and then asking them questions that they can't dodge. Like when I say, does this suck?
Just, you know, flat,
like,
out.
Even the pause that they say, like, you know, they're like, it doesn't suck.
But what were you going for with this?
Exactly. And if somebody I really respect hates something and I still like it, that's how I know, like, I'm onto something.
Okay.
You know, it's like, oh, wow, like, you do think it kind of sucks, but I still want to do it. That's, for me, a form of grounding.
Being
like that. And so a lot of times I'll try to, like, and I'll ask a lot of different people and some people whose opinion I don't appreciate. And I'll be like, oh, you like it? You know, like, so there is, like, for me, yeah, those kind of situations that really help me get my creative juice.
It sparks the creativity right back.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Okay. All right. I hope you guys are listening because that was a super gem right there.
It's a focus group, basically. That's what they, you know.
What's the another question is, what's the most challenging part of your creative process? Do you find the most challenging part?
Yeah, I think this idea of making stuff for deadlines, whether it be for an exhibition or an art fair or anything that says like you have to make art by this period of time,
right?
And it has to look like this or that. That's hard because I think we make our best work when we're not. We take more risk when we don't feel like we're, you know,
caged in with any type of restrictions and parameters. Yeah,
exactly. So a lot of my challenge is that, you know, how do I make something that feels really authentic to myself, knowing that there's a deadline at times.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that, sometimes, and I didn't realize, for instance, that I was a small business owner until I'd been doing it for 10 years, you know, so
yeah,
still trying to learn, which I think everyone really has to learn, is how do you value your own time as an artist, as a creative person, because I'll do it for free.
Yeah. And so because you love doing it.
Yeah. And so when someone says, I'll pay you, you're like, oh. You know, I mean, you can't, you know, a lot of, that's a weird thing.
It's a hard conversation for a lot of creatives.
So I think that's I think that's the biggest obstacle I face. I think overall is not only how to organize my time, but then how to value it. Even though I'm a pretty successful artist.
Mm-hmm.
But then, and the best thing is when you talk to friends like Rashid Johnson and the Astor Gates, other artists who are good friends of mine who are like way more commercially successful. And I listen to them talk about artists like, you know, Julie Moretti or Mark Bradford.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, you know, it's always relative. No matter how, you know, successful you are. And then long, you know, because we know how many artists made a lot of money in their lifetimes that wound up dying broke or their children didn't have anything. And that's something that I think a lot about. How do you create generational
wealth? Yeah. So I read about a piece that you have, a permanent installation down in Montgomery, Alabama, at the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, called Rise Up. So it depicts a cement wall with statues of Black heads and bodies and arms raised in surrender. Tell us about that piece, man.
Yeah, and that piece, it's fascinating because almost every week I get a text message or an Instagram message or an email from someone who went down to the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, which is also known as the National Lynching Museum.
Are you serious?
Yeah, and so Brian Stevenson, this incredible activist, civil rights lawyer, whose primary focus is criminal justice reform, recognize the deep connections between the criminal justice system and slavery and even lynching, the ways in which institutional racism in various forms was played out on Black bodies across the country, and how that we don't acknowledge that as a deep part of our history. And so he, as a lawyer, conceptualized this artwork, really, which is this National Memorial for Peace and Justice. And he didn't call it the Lynching Museum, because if you call it the Lynching
Museum, you can't, they're not going to do that.
They're not
going to let that fly.
But when it's peace and justice, you're like, oh, you know, what does lynching have to do with peace and justice? And that's about coming to terms with the past and atonement. And I was invited by Brian. The movie Just Mercy is, he wrote an incredible book called Just Mercy.
Okay.
And the movie featuring Michael B. Jordan is opening in the next few months to tell the story of his life. I was invited to create an artwork for that space. And I had already made a version of the sculpture called Raise Up, which was actually inspired by a photograph by a colored South African photographer named Ernest Cole of miners being strip searched during apartheid. And there was something about this idea of these men who's with their arms raised facing a wall that to me was, you know, was really powerful. It was really heartbreaking, but also I thought that if I could look at, take part of that photograph, which is just the top halves of their body, and crop it and make a sculpture, it might tell a different story, because we know that, you know, in the African-American baptism tradition, you know, part of, you know, the body's, you know, raising up with your arms in the water, and then thinking about this idea of wading in the water and all the other ways in which surrender plays in to the African-Americans experience, and thinking about the connection between Black South Africans' experiences and Black Americans. And so that was in February 2014 that I made that sculpture, the mini version of it. And then a few months later, in July of 2014, you know, a young man named Michael Brown was murdered by the police in Ferguson, Missouri. And the kind of call to action wound up being hands up, don't shoot.
Right.
And I thought that this, and it was amazing that something, an artwork that I'd made earlier that year about something that happened 50 years ago in another part of the world spoke in a way very eloquently to something that was happening here in the United States, you know, in the future of when I made it.
Right.
And so when Brian asked me to make a piece for the museum, I thought that this kind of sculpture, this sculpture really a larger than a life-size version of this sculpture, which I had titled Raise Up, could really be, you know, profound in that space. And I'm really happy to hear from a lot of people that it works.
It's an amazing piece from the photos I've seen. I'm anxious to have the opportunity to go on there and actually see it.
You got to. And the smaller version of the sculpture is up at the Portland Art Museum. So I hope you come and see it.
Perfect. Perfect. You used the word heartbreaking when you talked about how the photo, the effect the photo had on you before you created, as you were creating that piece. As heartbreaking as it is, for a lot of us, it's commonplace. How do you take something that, as Black people in America, something that we are used to dealing with, how do you turn that into art in a way that conveys the pain and any additional emotion that you want to convey through that piece? Because honestly, when I saw it, I was, it had an impact on me. But as you're describing it and the photo that it came from, my initial response was like, oh yeah, we see it all the time. Mm-hmm. So like, What happens in your process where you're able to turn something like that and I wouldn't call it mundane, but just so commonplace. Mm-hmm. How do you turn something like that? Even like, you know, just some of the things you've done with the basketball. Like, these are just things that we see all the time. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
Well, I think, again, going back to music, I think a lot about, you know, Sam Cooke singing, you know, it's been a long time coming, but change is going to come. Mm-hmm. Or Marvin Gaye, you know, Mercy, Mercy Me. And even Bill Withers and Lean on Me. And like, this idea that so many Black musicians and Black artists have done forever is taking pain and turning it into something is both that is also beautiful in the expression of that pain. And part of, and yeah, and that's like the part of the, not the entirety of the Black experience, Black American experience, I should say, is pain and suffering, but that is a part of the narrative. And how do we both address that, but also find beauty and because through beauty is, I think, a way through it.
I was just sitting there enthralled, like, okay, no, you're right. You're right. Yeah.
I mean, I just think when I thought about Sam, I mean, just the pain that you can hear in certain gospel songs like this, like, but there's also a hope. And at its best, not in everything, but at its best in some of my work, I think you hopefully touch on that, you know, mm-hmm. that grace or that beauty and that power. So that's why I'm so happy that you're playing the Black Righteous Bass playlist, because a lot of it is about like how we, as specifically African Americans and also Afro Caribbeans, who are the descendants of, you know, slaves in the United States, were able to convert, you know, this anger of against injustice into a defiance that also can only best be described as, you know, the beautiful struggle, you know, and that's to me the what I try to illustrate in my work.
So for anyone that doesn't know or doesn't is unfamiliar with the community playlist community playlist campaign that we have on 96.7, the way it works is we reach out to tastemakers, influencers, small business owners, people in the community that are inspirations to others, and we ask them, you know, what's the music that moves you? We ask them for about 15 to 20 songs, and we create a playlist out of that. Hank has blessed us with about, it seems like about 40 of these joints in here. This is an amazing list. Looking at it, we've got everything from Malcolm X speeches, songs by Marvin Gaye. I see some Mos Def on here, some Nina Simone. You mentioned Beautiful Struggle. Talib is on here as well. Who are you? What are you listening to these days? Some of the new artists or just artists, period, that you're checking
music
out.
Music-wise, I'm just stuck listening to NPR. Like, I can't believe that this is real.
The whole impeachment situation?
I mean,
where we are politically.
Yeah, our president is a magical entertainer. You know, that, like, he's turned our lives into reality television.
And, absolutely.
Like, we live in melodrama on the most serious news outlets. Where I'm like,
yeah.
This is like, is this real? So I can't listen to music without really, I'm just like, I can't understand. Yeah. I'm just trying to like, is this real life? I'm just kind of trying to.
Right. There were definitely times when I was like, he can start a war with a tweet the way he's going right now.
And the military finds out through the tweets. Right. I'm like, how is this? I mean, and again, I'm like, I got to be 1% as good as him. And if there's 100 of me.
Oh, my God.
But what are you listening to?
Man, okay. Robert Glasper's mixtape. Okay. I was on that a couple times this morning. That thing's crazy. Gold Link, definitely. I love his new project. Mm-hmm. That Bandana project with Freddie Gibbs and
okay, you gotta send that to me.
Oh my God. Yes. Yes.
So I can turn off NPR.
Freddie Gibbs and Madlib.
Okay, Madlib.
And
okay.
it is insane. They got a song on there with Pusher and Killer Mike.
Okay.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. I usually start with that song. Like if I don't know where to go, I'll hit that first.
Could you play a taste for the audience?
Oh, you know what? I will. Right, I will. And I've been struggling to get it on the air. I got to do a clean version of it. But
just a few seconds.
I'm going to edit it myself just and I'm going to put it in. Yeah, definitely going to. We'll tune into that. Definitely.
Right here.
Right here on the numbers.
Nice.
You hear it.
It's going to speak for us. It's going to speak for itself, you know what I mean? K-Season, back off my pastor daughter into Jesus' peace. Yeah. Dropping this blow on the basement floor, my yeast speaking. Yeah. Revving the fan, I pledge allegiance. Undisputed, 40 acres and a mule they gave us. Cooking the eagle, hot pot, spoons and needles. Yeah. Sold a piece of crack to police and Mario Van Peebles. Serving every prime green and pookie with that vanilla smoothie. Scary Gary and near my neighborhood, some life illusion. Yeah. Vladimir Banana Clip, move with Russian collusion shooters. Off track, or selling every suit on computers. Yeah. Pivin' and never die, Chad Butler in heaven, chunking deuces. Chunking deuces, a hard white fish that I made a wish. But smoking, scrubbing down my kitchen, I'm never gonna wash a dish. It's Mr. Clean, pass all power model. Because you don't know how hard you riding for the air to your pocket. In 1998, I sold the Glock 19 chopper. 2018, I'm finna reclaim my up time and cop the roadie flooded. Maxine Waters. Off the poison, keep the vaccines off us. We got a reality star in the goddamn office. Quite like the Reagan days. Banana Ghetto said he used to move chickens in the Noriega days. I disrespect his name and he signed my face with the razor blade. Baby Tony, top of the family like Johnny Sacramone. Chopping up this block, white top of some Yoshiyama motors. Whoever kill him first gon' get promoted. Well, I was getting away with murder before Denzel Ayola gangsta
came. Young and dope money, just half at it. Muggin' make money, more money. Mathematics, muggin' po-po's. They coming for your money. Muggin' lay low, I mean low. Like no money, muggin'. Young and dope money, just half at it. Muggin' make money, more money. Mathematics, muggin' po-po's. They coming for your money. Muggin' lay low, I mean low. Like no money.
Hey. Real bars are the ill bars. These scars are the only real proof they couldn't kill gods. My coke hand is still sketching out my memoirs. What I did to door panels on them wind stars. Gym stars left cuts in the dinner place. It's new stash spots, the AC don't just ventilate. Take over your blocks, youngs are gonna assimilate. We all break bread like going Dutch on a dinner date. The love of your life rap wouldn't wear fake watches. The serial number don't match the gift boxes. The bezel on her Babylon blue due to Tinashe. The bitch told me two-tone rollies was too blase. Yeah. Way more chemical than political. PTSD from what I wait on the digital. It was snowfall and Reagan gave me the visual. Obama opened his doors knowing I was a criminal. I took a risk, I took a brick. Took a road trip to a Motel 6. Get it wholesale and you know I won't tell. Ish, ride coattails, then he really won't that lit. Just another in the mix, Huggins. I'm rich, Huggins. Tell me, is you Alpo or Mick Huggins? Bet it all, roulette, all on my wrist, Huggins. Like Cleo setting it off, taking your Huggins shit. Ooh!
Young Huggins, dope money, just half at it. Yeah, Huggins, money, more money. Mathematics, Huggins, no poles. They coming for your money, Huggins, they low. I mean low, like no money, Huggins. Huggins, dope money, just half at it. Huggins, make money, more money. Mathematics, Huggins, no. Like talking to baby mama, Huggins, ain't rap. Tell that this is that show money, Huggins.
I know a guy in my neighborhood. He came home from work one day and caught his best friend in the hall with his wife. They had all day to go to bed. Pulled out a .45 and shot both of them. Next morning, his friend went down to the jail. He said, Fred, don't take it so hard. He said, it could have been worse. He said, what you mean it could have been worse? He said, man, two people dead. I might get the electric chair. You tell me it could have been worse? He said, yeah, baby, it could have been worse. He said, what you mean? He said, hell, if you'd have came Thursday instead of Friday, you'd have gotten me too.
Final question. What are some artists that you're checking out now? Like, who should, as someone who is just starting to get into art, mm-hmm. who are some of the people we should be checking out?
That's a tough one. I mean, there's an artist that one of the first artists who I come to think about who, because she challenges me so much, mm-hmm. is named Christine Sun Kim. She lives in Berlin, but is from California. She's deaf, and she forces me both through her creativity, but also her activism to think about ableism, about like how with a lot of my work, I don't we're doing a radio show.
Right, and right.
Not to say that everything has to be available to everyone, but if there's an opportunity, how are you inclusive of other communities? And also, right. how do you learn like how to, you know, the fact that I don't know sign language limits my ability to learn to communicate with other people. But then also Fabiana Rodriguez, who's an amazing artist slash activist who lives in the Bay Area, who, you know, started Super PAC and has pushed a lot of different political engagement through creativity. And I started my own Super PAC with my friend Eric Gottesman called Four Freedoms, F-O-R Freedoms. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And our goal is really to rebrand America and to rebrand patriotism, to finally try to live up to the values that our country has always said it stood for.
You guys did a collaboration, right? You have a collaborative piece?
Yeah, we've done so many collaborations, but we remade Norman Rockwell's Four Freedoms paintings, which were really iconic in the 1940s, but didn't represent visually
all of America.
All of America. Mm-hmm. And then we also wound up collaborating with about 100 artists to do billboards in all 50 states, plus DC and Puerto Rico in 2018.
Okay.
And we think that, wow, you know, as artists, all we do is tell stories.
Yeah.
And how is it that we allow, you know, these politicians who aren't creative to tell the stories to dictate what our society is about? And I think a lot of us are so mad at these politicians, but I'm like, you should be mad at yourself. Like, yeah, we should be telling the stories. Yeah. We, as creative community, don't want to get our hands dirty because we feel that somehow we'll be absolved. But in reality, if we're not getting into the narrative conversations and we're not, you know, not only being reactionary, but being visionary, we're going to be stuck playing defense. And I don't want to play defense because our survival depends on us, the creative class,
right,
you know, digging in and helping to solve really complicated problems that people have been trying to solve in simple ways for centuries.
So does this lead you down a path where you're, you know, designing a piece for someone that's running next, are you a Shepherd Fairey situation? Like,
yeah, I mean, Shepherd Fairey is an inspiration, for sure. But I think that's, like, you know, that's still propaganda. But again, true, look how well it worked. Yeah. You know, hope.
Yeah. Like, it worked very well.
It took four letters and a pretty picture. Like, we didn't even know that guy.
Right. Right.
Like,
right,
in 2006, like, yeah, you know, like, no one knew. If someone told you in like, February of 2006 that the next president was going to be both mixed, right, person who,
right,
his father was from Kenya and his name would be Barack Hussein Obama.
Not happening.
And I'm like, I'll bet you $1 million.
It's not happening.
Like, no, you would have lost all that money.
Yo, hard.
But, you know, and it's, you know, but, and then recognizing how creatives embrace them, thinking about the Yes We Can, like, mm-hmm, you know, Will.i.am just basically took a speech and just like remix it slightly, and then, yeah, other creatives got involved, and all of a sudden we have a new opportunity. But where we stopped was thinking that our job was done.
Okay.
Where he was just the beginning,
right?
You know, he was the, you know, the entry key, you know. And then another credible storyteller, you know, came along and was like, oh, all you need is a good brand. I've been building a brand for 40 years and my name means win. And I got a big brass sign that says win,
right?
So I can tell you, I can tell a story. And right, I think now we need to move away from the singular narrative, the singular heroes. So it might include, you know, making something for somebody, but also telling that somebody what to think.
Yeah.
Like, you might be a good mouthpiece, but, like, you got to speak to broader issues. And when they make mistakes, still sticking behind them, you know, like, not trying to tear somebody down, but also trying to encourage them and lift them up, which doesn't mean you can't critique, right, but, like, to do it in a productive way, the way a coach might, rather than, you know, somebody who's just trying to, like, do you want better.
Yeah, yeah. And listen, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Really, Portland community, I really encourage you to get down to this exhibit. We're here till January, correct?
Yeah, the show is up through January.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Thank you so much.
See you soon.
All right, now.
Got ambushed.
This is a tearjerker.
Won't be televised, but in the land of milk and honey, there's a date you gotta sell it by. Otherwise, it just expires and spoils. And these folks jump out the pot when the water too hot, 'cause the fire boils inside. You
go to church to find you some religion, and all you hear is conniving and gossip and contradiction. And you try to vote and participate in the government, and the Democrats is acting like Republicans. You join an organization that know black history, but ask them how they plan to make money, and it's a mystery. Looking for the remedy, but you can't see what's hurting you. The revolution's here, the revolution is personal. They call me the political rapper, even after I tell them I don't fuck with politics. I don't even follow it. I'm on some KRS, Ice Cube, Chris Wallace. This shit main source, De La Soul, bumping to Apocalypse. Now, now. Say I'm intelligent. No, it's cause I'm dope. If I was whack, I'd be irrelevant. I'm like the dope in your tracks until your high is settling. You lean to the left, the last is the best medicine. But the trouble you have today, you just can't laugh away. Stay optimistic, think a change is gonna come like Donny Hathaway. You have to pray on top of that act today, cause opportunities shrivel away like Tom Hanks a Castaway. Everybody passed away, the pastor prayed a family mourning. Everybody act according to the season that they born in. We fight in the streets, start bleeding till the blood is pouring. In the gutter, mothers cry to the Lord, we living by the sword. And all that folks want is safety, they going gun crazy. Same reason Reagan was playing war games in the 80s. Same reason I always rock dog chains on my babies. Struggle is beautiful, I'm too strong for your slavery.